Hello, this is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, with me, Michael Kuehl.
And me, Roger Bell West.
And as the coolth of the autumn creeps gradually across the warmth of the summer, we are going to be doing a miscellany, a hodgepodge, a gathering of different topics as fast as we can manage it this month.
We call it RPG in a minute, but we've never actually achieved this.
No, and we never actually will, Roger. You know this, don't you?
You may recall that over previous months we have mentioned the sad end of Alarms and Excursions, the venerable role-playing APA, and the new Ever and Anon, which is aiming to carry on the tradition. Because this is now online only, and doesn't have the complicated printing requirements and so on that the old one did, I have attempted to join this, and as long as things more or less work out, by the time this comes out, the first issue, number 3, with my content in it, should be there. That Mike, of course, has his content in the 2 previous issues as well.
And all of that is freely available at the website, which we will put into the show notes.
Everanon.org, but yes, I'll put it in the show notes as well.
All right, I did. Well, it is a bit of a cute title, but people are writing stuff, and some of the stuff is good. I would like to mention briefly that the Bundle of Holding is redoing its tiny D6 bundle, mostly the dungeon and low-tech focused stuff. But you might like to give it a look. And if you want to know why, you can refer to our previous episode when we talked about it.
I'll see if I can dig that out of the archives and put in a link in the show notes. I will also say thank you to Joseph Reynolds, who dropped some money in our tip jar.
Which we appreciate it. We really do.
It does encourage us to keep doing this. And talking of keeping doing this...
On and on and on. It's the tail end of summer here in High Wycombe. Things are getting cooler, which is a relief to Roger and to all us all. It is once again time to review the works that we should have done all over August on social media, but we're doing here instead, which is RPG A Day, which is a thing put up on the internet by somebody every year, in which you are given a prompt a day to say something, do something, write something about role-playing games from that prompt.
Now, some of these have been questions or, you know, name a specific thing that whatever. This year they are one word prompts.
Yeah, it has been pictures at one stage, I seem to recall. They have been ingenious, but here we're back to the basic format, with the option of rolling a dice and creating a question around the prompt. And if we get to the point where we feel uninspired, maybe we'll do that, or maybe not. Let us begin. The first prompt is patron. Now, we know what a patron is. It's a wretch who, when you don't need the help, ignores you, and who, when you need it, throws it at you, according to Dr. Johnson.
Yeah.
But in a role-playing context, it's some knob or other, somebody more powerful than you, who condescends to give you a hand from time to time. And it strikes me that players expect, players being unreasonable people, that a patron is going to be entirely a benefit towards you. It's certainly an advantage in GURPS, so it's an advantage that can be mitigated in various ways.
I think it is noted for a start that it often comes along with a duty. As it might be, the agency will give you stuff to help on your missions, but it's going to require you to go and do those missions.
Lord Framingham will give you equipment, but he does want you to go and retrieve his wayward daughter. And this seems to me that there's always a certain flavour of this somehow, because you're tangled into one of the great and the good, and therefore that puts you in the path of the people who have opinions about that member, or the great and the good, or the class of people that it's in. I think I'm quite admiring of the way the icons work in 13th Age. The icons being the really top-level great and the good, the emperor and the great gold worm and the lich lord and the good and the bad and the powerful across the setting. And whether you're their enemy or whether you're their friend, you're still tangled up in their affairs. And you volunteer for this because there are the obvious advantages. But there isn't any getting out of the fact that being in their circle has social implications. And I rather like that.
Mm. Yeah, the first thing I think of course, is the traveller meaning of the term, which is specifically the person who employs a bunch of world-hopping ne'er-do-wells for some purpose, usually a dubiously legal purpose.
The chap in the bar with a strange symbol floating above his head. In video game.
Or, you know, that classic one of Traveller, the woman who says, they're out to get me. And then the apparently mental health professionals turn up and say, don't worry, sir. Sorry you've been bothered. And with the classic Traveller D6 resolution, this can be entirely as it appears, or she can be entirely legitimate. And you just don't know, even if you've read the book, which I thought was rather neat. But also I think about the organisation-based campaigns I've run, the World War II game most obviously. I mean, also to some extent the Bayern campaign. I like sandboxes, I've had fun with sandboxes, but there is something encouraging, I think, about being able to say, right, your adventure this week is...
Yeah.
Catch this guy, explore that planet.
Yeah, they're, and you are invariably tangled up with the people giving you this because you're stuck on the bloody spaceship, and you're not getting home until everybody turns around and goes home.
And nobody resigns from the agency because we've got this pension liability. We don't like to talk about it. Though also. It's getting to the edge of Patreon. I'm just remembering Dr. Bob's recent comments on the Blade Runner RPG, where it's an investigative game. It's very explicitly investigative.
Yeah.
But what you might do is say, right, well, this is going to need some lab work. We have scoured this crime scene. We are sending the evidence off to the lab. And rather than anybody having to make rolls about it or whatever, this goes entirely out of player space. And at the end of shift, which is two or three times a day, I think,
yeah,
it comes back. You know, your results are back. Now you can go on to the next thing.
God, but that's efficient.
I assume there are delays if you ask for something complicated. I haven't read the game myself, but anyway.
Let me prompt you with prompt, which is the next word.
Criticality.
I beg your pardon.
If people shout prompt criticality, run, though it's probably too late. Though...
there will be a footnote to explain that, I hope.
I'll just look it up on somebody else's connection. Is this perhaps in the sense of the nudge to get the players going in the right direction, which I have certainly felt required to do sometimes? I'm sure you have too. It's not that they're doing the wrong thing. It's that they're chasing off after a false lead. That is just dull because you haven't even thought about that particular branch of the possibilities.
Well, maybe it's exciting because you haven't thought about the possibilities, and maybe you feel like rewriting. I think prompt means to me something out of. Of writing and writing classes, and it's something I see in solo journaling games. Which I've only tried one, which was the 1,000-year-old vampire, and I didn't complete that. But you are given something to do with the character's life that you're portraying, and you write the journal entry describing that. Mm. And I'd say that Brindlewood Bay, with its not determined until there's enough information out there, as a true mystery of what's really going on, is very close to that. It's something that's getting more common in role-playing games this idea of co-creation spreads across the hobby.
They're using a different literary antecedent. When things get boring, send a guy through the door with a gun in his hand.
Yes, that a couple of guys. If you're feeling generous.
This is also a prompt. This is a spur to action. But meanwhile, tavern.
I have seen at least two games. One of them, tiny taverns, which comes to mind, and one of which I bought but didn't actually enjoy, which I won't mention. Focused on the tavern. On the tavern as a place of soap opera and of generating non-dungeon focused, non-great and heroic adventures. Myself, I would rather make it part of the home base than the whole focus of the game. I mean, we've had taverns in the game since the beginning, and you meet a chap in a tavern, and he says to you, is a classic opening. But I liked very much, back in the old days, Gympie's in Parvis, which was the adventurer's tavern had just enough detail and background to be able to create stories which were focused around the town and around the tavern. And I like that. And I think I'm sort of grateful for the increased support and the increased idea generation that the current wave is creating. There's also an online ongoing story, The Wandering Inn, which I must get back to and finish reading.
Yeah. If you are the people who have to run the tavern, whether that's ownership or just working there, you have the sort of static adventure, but the adventure comes to you, as in, oh, what was that team? The Love Boat. You've got the recurring cast of the crew, but each episode has a new bunch of people with their problems that again have to be solved. And I think you could have something similar here. You know, somebody comes to the tavern and they have a specific tavern related problem. That may cut it down a bit. The Fantasy Tavern, of course, is desperately ahistorical because it is essentially based on the Wild West Saloon. Yet another of the connections. And bearing in mind, the bar that you pass drinks over was invented by Isambard Kingdom Brunel. It does not occur at any point before that. And he did it so that people could be served faster at railway stations.
Gosh.
But also, most of Europe didn't do table service, which is, again, a standard fantasy tavern thing. You go up and get your own drinks, and there is a shelf against the back wall, and the barman pours the drinks from the shelf, turns back and passes them to you.
Yeah.
So at this point, it's not... Yeah, the fantasy tavern isn't going to be historical anyway. You might as well have fun with it. And what I go from there is this a world in which adventurer is a recognised thing you can be? Because otherwise, you are probably, in most situations, at most times, the only foreigners here.
So, that's true. Yeah.
And nobody is going to want to talk to you, and you certainly aren't going to run into anybody else who's doing what you're doing. So, again, it's a concession that I think has to be made to make an interestingly playable world. But... yeah.
If you want to go a bit weirder than your Love Boat suggestion, I think we could do a Fantasy Island version of this, in which people come in with their really weird requests and see what happens.
Yeah, and there's a limit to what you can expect in a fantasy world, given that you don't have pervasive magic, or maybe you do, but anyway. Onwards to number four, Message.
This is me pitching this to you. Message, what do you got?
Well, I think communication speed. How long does it take the news to get from Echt to Ghent? Can you outrun the news? Can you make investments knowing which side won the battle, as the Rothschilds did after Waterloo? It's really hard work to do this realistically, especially if you do it with a paper map, but it's really easy with software. I've done that.
The traveller setting is carefully created without any faster-than-light communications, and a jump each time is a week. And the speed of communication is the speed of ship, which makes things very odd. There are no carrier pigeons, which is what I believe the Rothschilds were using.
No, they had an actual courier who had seen the battle and made it all the way across to London.
Oh, I wonder where I got the carrier prince.
That's my understanding anyway. I may be wrong. The thing I remember wanting to do when the Traveller Civil War was happening, this was the bridge between... this was basically the Mega Traveller era. They had this ongoing meta plot, which was generally unpopular. We've talked about that before. Every news item had a location and a date, and it occurred to me it could be quite fun to plot out, okay, you know, this is the full set of news items, and here we are on a planet here. What have we actually heard? What has reached us so far?
Yeah, well, that was what the Traveller News Service was.
But all they did was, you know, here are these news items, and here is a location and a date for each one. You get to the right place, you can hear about a consequence before the cause. particularly because you get non-standard travel speeds, and the fastest, well, the standard express mail, which is what you would probably assume for most news, is a 4 parsec jump every week. Where the traffic justifies it. But jumps go up to 6 parsecs, and if the astrography is right, that news can outrun the express network if somebody is paid to get it there.
I'm assuming that the nobody builds jump 6 couriers except the Imperium, because there wouldn't be the return. It wouldn't be used frequently enough.
During times of civil war, I think I could argue that it would be used jolly often.
Well, yeah, quite.
there's arbitrage money to be made there.
And in the billions, very possibly. All right, my note on message says, and I don't know where I got this piece of bad GM advice, but it would be fun, is to write a note which says, read this carefully. Let your eyes bug out a little. Snort in amusement and then scribble something on it and pass it back to me, and then give it to a player.
I have written a note to a GM that said, just nod and smile, but that wasn't a paranoia game.
Okay.
So, ancient.
I think we can probably blame it on Tolkien, but just about every fantasy setting, and a lot of the SF ones, has the ancient civilization as a core excuse for what the setting now is. I like in media res starts for things. I may have said this, they're going to come back to this later on. But it's probably best not to know what the ancient civilization is like until you actually need it. And I can conceive of settings which don't have an ancient civilization back there, but they'd probably be pretty new and only just out of the packaging.
Well, most obviously, to my mind, transhuman space.
It has all of Earth's history.
Yes.
But only the last bit is really relevant.
But it doesn't have any lost super tech. Now, the thing that, particularly for fantasies, this strikes me as tying into the essential conservative worldview of a lot of fantasy. Because if you have an ancient civilization in fantasy, very often it is the lost golden age, and things were great in those days, and now we are there in the fallen latter days.
Yeah.
The Lord of the Rings is an obvious example here. And the best you can hope for is to turn back the clock to when things were better. You don't generally think in terms of making progress and turning things forward to a future where things can be better. That isn't in the mindset.
Mm. And yes, it's incredibly conservative, and that fits in with what we know of Tolkien's own preferences.
And I think lot of fantasy does that, not necessarily because the author feels that way, but simply because they're copying Tolkien. Anyway.
Yeah, I think all of the often unnecessary and unused deep history of something like Han is put in place because that's what Tolkien did.
I was chatting with someone on Mastodon this morning who's saying one of his standard fantasy campaign tropes is the great big empire of everybody collapsed 300 years ago. And the major threat now is that somebody might build another one.
Yeah.
Which still gets you all your old ruins and mysterious unreadable books and things. But...
yeah.
Thinking about this, I don't think Traveller's Ancients go in quite the same direction. Without spoilers, but I think there are the Ancients and there is one particular adventure... in which you can learn quite a lot about them. Though you can pick up clues here and there. They suited it quite well through the original adventures. But nobody is saying, oh, it was glorious in those days. They're saying, well, no. It was probably great if you were one of them, but chances are you got caught up in one of their wars fought with, you know, black holes and tennis rackets.
Yeah. Well, it's clear that the Ancients collapsed into incredible universe-shaking violence. But they are there to explain certain storytelling tropes that are there,
why there are all these vaguely humanoid-looking aliens about.
There is no moral lesson behind the Ancients in Traveller other than
don't
pride goeth before flaw. Yeah. Fall, you know.
So
okay, yeah. Let me toss this at you: motive.
And this is, I'm going to say the thing that I'm sure I've said before, one of Ken Hite's points, which is that going into the haunted house and meeting the ghosts and surviving is horror. Mm. Having survived that and looking for another haunted house is monster hunting. They can look quite similar. They have a lot of the same props and monsters and things, but they are not the same genre. And this is where I think it's really handy to have a campaign about essentially good guys. You know, there is some injustice. Yeah. We ought to do something about it. Maybe somebody ought to do something about it, but at least we are going to start. In Trail of Cthulhu, they make a big thing of saying, why are you putting your life and sanity on the line?
It's a reasonable question.
Later. Yeah, but it's thrown onto the players. You know, generate a character who is going to be enthused about continuing to do this, not just one who's going to say, well, I've got my uncle's old house, I'm going to retire now. This also drifts me into the old concept of adversarial gaming, and I think the way disadvantages, which I think of as a GURPS thing, that I think there may have been in Hero first, probably. But
the
basic idea that you take something that is disadvantageous to your character, and in return you get character points to make yourself more tougher or whatever, I think is an explicit bribe, because under an adversarial gaming style, the optimum PC is the egg. They have no connections, they have no motivations. Nobody can reach out to them and make them do a thing by appealing to their sense of whatever, because they don't have a sense of whatever. All they want to do is get more money. And frankly, I find that dull.
It's a motivation, but going into haunted houses is generally not the way to get it.
Yeah, it's a motivation to go down dungeons, but I find it a very dull one. And in particular, it's not a good motivation to go down this particular dungeon when you could instead carry on to the next town and go down its dungeon instead.
Yeah. I like what Trail of Cthulhu is doing. You have to be a bit cracked to want to investigate this sort of thing, but at least in this, you get to choose the sort of lunatic you are.
Mm.
But I find sometimes GMs in investigative games rely too much on the meta motivation of this is the sort of story we are telling. And you need enough motivation to go on doing the inconvenient things that investigating requires, And that needs a bit much than, oh, I'm in a horror investigative story, and we've all agreed to that, and we're sitting around the table. You need something to make it personal.
Yeah, there's something about that I want to touch on under a later topic, in fact.
Okay, well, let's move on.
So tell me of journeys.
Well, there are always journeys to be going on in adventurous things, and sometimes you want the journey to be meaningful and flavorful and to provide a moment as you go from A to B, perhaps even to serve the plot. But sometimes you just want to say, imagine images of a caravan crossing a desert, a plane crossing the oceans, a train crossing a continent.
The red line across the map, yeah.
The red line across the map, and then leave it at that. But, and on the third hand, sometimes you want to do around the world in 80 days, which is picaresque, I suppose. It's the point is in the journey and being the people on that journey whom you have chosen to be. So I'm not sure how much... I think a journey can be a good way to learn a setting, assuming your characters don't know about the setting or the players don't know about the setting. One of the early GURPS adventures is Caravan to Ayn Arras, which has a lot of things happening, going basically from point A to point B. And it doesn't really have a lot of plot, but it has a lot of incident. Mm. And that is sometimes good enough. But making a journey the whole of the campaign is a difficult one. And sometimes you want the bit of tramping from A to B and getting your feet sore, and sometimes you don't.
Yeah, I think I've talked before about my idea for a passage crew mini campaign. In other words, there is a starship at A. You have to get it to Z. You are being hired to do this. You're being paid a basic stipend to do that, and you know, fuel and maintenance or whatever. But any money you can make along the way, well, that's fine. You can keep it. The advantage of this to me, compared with your classic traveller, you've all just busted out of the service and you've got this merchant ship, is that it has a definite destination. There's always a reason to keep moving on.
And there's a definite end to it.
Yeah.
You are not just keeping going until the point where you become bored, which will be eventual.
Yeah. The problem I do see with this sort of campaign is that environmental hazards, at least in the games I favour, are hard to make fun. Some of that's a rules thing, you know. Canonically in GURPS, usually the answer is roll appropriate type of survival. Mm. And then, you know, if you made the appropriate type of survival, well, you know what to do about the sandstorm, the blizzard, the whatever.
Yeah.
There are several traveller adventures which boil in. There's at least one in 2300, or there was in the old days, which boil down to you are halfway around a planet. You've got to get to the other end, and there is basically there might be somebody out to get you on the way, but that is very minor compared with the number of things that are here is a weird bit of hostile alien fauna, flora, gravity, whatever.
And one of the problems with Traveller is that normally you know about all the already noted hazards. You may get surprised by the way the customs treat you or the customs of the natives, but what's dangerous about the planet will be noted, and there will be articles on your computer to tell you about
that too. But it's just even with that, facing the challenges is just not as... I find it not as satisfying, though there have been many good books which are essentially human versus nature.
Yeah.
The Worst Journey in the World is an obvious example. And I would like that to figure more in my games, but I haven't found a way of making it do the interesting thing. In general, I'm in favour of journeys, especially in most settings, most eras... Most people are not travellers in the broad sense of the word. I don't think it's ever really been talked about much in the traveller setting. There is a class of ship called a liner, which implies people are taking FTL journeys for recreation. But most people you meet don't travel. mostly you are weird outsiders. In a medieval connected setting, this is absolutely a thing. Obviously, the more you get professional adventurers, you go from dungeon to dungeon, the less this is true. But most of the time, it's definitely you are the weird outsiders compared with the people who have been quite happy living in their own village for the entire life and are planning to continue to do so.
Most people do not long to go on pilgrimage.
Yeah. Ooh, I think that's a good scenario frame.
there is, I think, implied in the Traveller setup that there is a culture separate from the individual cultures. There is a culture of people who travel from place to place, who have broken from their home and are going around and taking advantage of the empire. But and they may recognize each other as being a special type of person, but most people just don't think about that sort of thing.
I suspect also they are simply rare enough that running into each other is unusual. And you can increase your odds by hanging around spaceport bars, but...
Yeah.
So...
Okay, let me chuck explore at you, which is different from a journey because...
Because you don't know where you're going, or how long you're going to take, or what you're going to eat when you get there. This is a thing that, to me, Traveller always promised and didn't really deliver by the time I was playing it, because by the time I was playing it, they had established the Imperium. You know, the core rules would say, yeah, here is how to generate your own subsector, but the Imperium would say, no, here is the Imperium, here are the worlds.
And it's very difficult to create in Traveller a place where no one has gone before.
Well, in Traveller especially, because there is... we've talked about travellermap.com before. It's a very good thing if you're running in the Imperial setting. But, yeah, everything is out there, except for the one sector which is canonically undefined.
Yeah, there are places, they have put together places where none of the cultures, none of the star-travelling cultures have gone, except maybe the ancients and strange things from between the stars. But mostly you're in your own culture's territory or you're in somebody else's culture's territory and they want to see your passport.
Yeah, and to be fair, that's what mostly 2300 does as well, though I will confess I'm very much enjoying the exploration element of Bayern.
Yes, it's fun.
You are going to places that no human has been to before, as far as anybody knows. And if they have, they didn't come back. So, inspire.
Meaning literally to breathe into and to breathe life into. I think the inspiration of a good campaign is often a question. And it's often a question about the sort of games and stories that are already out there. Such as, what about this story from Igor's point of view? Is the inspiration of my life with a master. And... what about a fantasy universe where the gods have died within historical time, which is one of my campaigns I've talked about recently, and also Eurasia by S. John Ross.
Was it Stephen R. Donaldson whose books were described as Lord of the Rings from Gollum's point of view?
Yeah. I'm not sure. It was the point of view of somebody who was feeling very, very sorry for him. So that maybe that's Gollum. I think I think having something you want answered, something you want explored, is the best quirk for a good campaign. But I just think I want to do something like is also a good inspiration. I've got a long list of things that I have proposed to my players and which never got anywhere, but I still want those campaigns to come around. Sometimes the question is only, what can I do with this particular game? And that's a good question too.
Yeah, I also think about what inspires PCs. This is not usually explicit. Though in Pendragon and recent RuneQuest, you do have the, you know, I will become impassioned because of my love of my homeland or whatever, and therefore
my hatred of those people over there.
And therefore I will hit those people over there more effectively. But this also comes back to what we were saying earlier, of, you know, why do the investigators risk their lives and sanity? What is the reward that they are getting in terms of their own cognition? Because clearly they aren't getting a reward in terms of external facts. You know, they're not getting money. They're not getting, you know, all expenses paid trip to the really nice asylum. So,
yeah.
So what inspires them? And I think that's a thing worth considering. I'm blowing my own trumpet here, but my character in the Watson Hall run through of Masks of Nyarlathotep, Rabbitsford. He was given to me basically by a whole lot of reading about combat stress in the Great War, where of course it was not really understood as a thing.
Yeah.
And how people worked out ways of coping with it. And it has always struck me particularly, I think because it was not such a cultural trauma in the US as it was here, but if you have characters in the 1920s who are investigating weirdness, their lives have been defined by what they did in the war and what happened to them in the war.
Yeah.
And that it really, I've always felt that it should be more important, and Rabbitsford was my way of engaging with that. And he actually had a pretty good war, but he saw some truly horrible things, and he came out of it, frankly, with a mission.
And then there is the character who had a good war and doesn't want it to end, and is using the adventure or the campaign as a means of living to that extent, to that intensity again.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, we can't all be Tor Heyerdahl.
No, is it Taken?
Oh, well, yeah, I heard about him as a kid doing you know, Contiki expedition and so on, and thinking, yeah, well, that's pretty nifty. I looked him up a few years ago and realised that a few years before that, he had been lurking around Norway blowing up Germans. And he found peacetime pretty boring. So, I shall move
on. At least he didn't blow up anybody else to gain his throne. Okay. I shall move you on to Origin.
Yeah, so, well, in the superhero sense, I suppose there's the canonical origin story. If you've got weird powers, I think it doesn't have to be superheroic for this to work. My 1960s Psionics campaign, I started in character generation saying, give me people who would sign up for this drug trial.
Yeah.
And then one of the key moments early in the campaign was, you wake up, you're in a plastic bag and there is a zipper close over your head. Yes, you're in a body bag in the back of a van going off to be disposed of. Also with psionic powers, but they didn't know that yet. I do love coming up with backstory for a character, not so much what specific defining moment, but what have they done up to this point. I think you have said, I can't remember whether you originated it, that the thing that's about to happen, in other words, the campaign, should be the most interesting thing that's ever happened.
Yeah.
I find that hard to remember. I get really carried away writing fun backstories and thinking, yeah, and at least sometimes it's, yeah, but this guy isn't going to fit this campaign at all. I just take him away and use him somewhere else.
I would say, one of the things I have said, one of the things I have observed in watching the superhero movies that you don't like, is that you always get the origin story.
It's more that I just haven't got round to them.
All right. Well, but I think that I noticed that in the latest wave, they are not doing the origin stories. They are beginning in media res and implying or going back and telling the origin story original. Later on in the TV series, if there is one, or not at all, if there's just a standalone movie. Later on, go on and tell the story of how they got to the media race bit, how they got from being just people to being strange folks. I think I think it can be worthwhile doing that with a team story, which most role playing campaigns turn out to be, with their origins and their background just implied and kept as something that will come up later.
I think this has a traditional error on the part of the filmmakers and to some extent TV makers, because I remember reading comics as a kid, and you didn't get to read comic number one of whatever hero it was, unless it was a new launch, which it usually wasn't. So you had to pick up, well, this guy wears red and gold armor and he can fly. It's not hard to pick up.
Yeah, I do wonder about the people who did not see Doctor Who from the first episode, and how much difference not having had all that background stuff makes to them.
Oh, I was one of them. It was completely irrelevant.
Okay. when did you come in? Who was the doctor?
Not quite the beginning of Tom Baker.
Okay. I can see why you might not want to ask too many questions about Tom Baker's origins.
He had left the monastery by then. No, it was... That's the thing. One of the things I enjoy about that sort of thing, one of the things I've enjoyed about playing the board game Sentinels of the Multiverse, which is, for those of you who haven't played it, based on a notional set of comics that don't actually exist. Some of the characters are clearly inspired by actual published in the real world superheroes. Some of them aren't. But that gives me the same feeling that I got reading comics as a kid of there might be all this backstory which is not accessible to me. But it's fun thinking that it might exist. In fact, it's more fun than finding out the real backstory. And that is why I stopped listening to the podcast where the creators of this universe explain various points of the backstory, because you're learning stuff, but no, it's much more fun just to see here is what's in the game and how might that work. But that's me.
I'm now remembering that I did, though my mind instantly went to reading the first Marvel comics. In fact, my at the age of slightly less than five, I think, my first introduction was were comics left in the children's wards at hospitals, and my first memories were of Lois Lane, Superman's girlfriend, and try figuring that out when you're four. Or maybe Marvel Man, as he was then called, which was just weird, you know.
But speak to me of flavour.
Caraway seeds added to corned beef hash add an interesting flavour. I haven't got anything here. I know what it means. It means the sense of the experience of the world of... For the flavour of Glorantha has ducks in it and trolls and each campaign has a flavour, a thing that's going to make people talk about it and remember it. But I have no general rule for how you put it in there. And I suspect if I asked my players what they remembered from my various campaigns, I would get a very eclectic bunch of memories. But I do mean it about the caraway seeds in corned beef hash.
Well, my universal flavour tip is, if in doubt, use more garlic. But my thought was that genre gets used to mean a lot of different things, and flavour might be a better term for one of them. The question is which. To me, I think it is how heroic are the PCs, not in terms of behaving well, but in terms of how much direct influence do they exert on the world. You know, can they hold off a barracks full of bad guys? Can you realistically send one of them in against 20, 50, 100 normal people and expect them to prevail? I don't know. You could also call that power level, but so I'm not sure. So instead,
I think flavor is a lower level and but more intense and meaningful thing.
For me, at least, if you use it without explaining what you mean by it, I'm probably not going to know what you mean by it. So that's not ideal. So I shall move on to path. In an abstract sense. Well, I'm reminded of some of the publicity that Ken Height and Robin Laws did when Gumshoe came out.
Yeah.
And if you look at a mystery adventure, an investigative adventure, I should say, in retrospect, it looks like a railroad because, yeah, we went here and that led us to B and that led us to C and that led us to D and E, but we went to D first and so on. So... yes, but I think it should be optional, and I think something Robin Laws said earlier was you should have multiple ways you can do things, not only multiple paths through the web of clues, but none of those nodes should be essential except for the very beginning and the very end.
Yeah.
And what he didn't didn't say, but I'm quite happy to do, is say, okay, after the adventure, let's prune out all the stuff that didn't get used and reuse them for the next adventure.
Economical, that, but on the other hand, you talked earlier of yanking them back with a prompt from going off down too many garden paths and too many diversions. Yeah,
I try to have a lot of options, but those tend to be the options that I think of. You know, here is this canonical corpse in a room. So, all right, let's look at the corpse. Let's identify him. Let's find out who he was, what he was doing. Let's get some evidence on the body, post-mortem, evidence elsewhere in the room, and so on. You know, you get all these things. Each of these will lead you in a different direction and possibly to different people and so on. But maybe the players will say something I simply haven't thought of.
And something that you haven't thought of, which is actually... reasonable and possibly relevant.
Yeah, one investigative game I ran a few years ago, and it was set in the then present day, involved among several people who had gone missing a university second year student, and a player asked, "Well, what's on her Facebook page?" Me, blank.
What is supposed to glory in that? I think that Robin Laws's idea of a clue map looks more like a cobweb leading from through various nodes to a single center, whereas I think a railroading investigative campaign looks like a map of a maze with one true path through it and a lot of dead ends.
Yeah, well, the traditional investigative adventure that was being held up as a bad example when they were saying you should play Gumshoe instead was, you know, here is the incident, here is the one clue you can find. You failed the roll to find the clue. Well, yeah, I guess you're stuffed now. I never experienced that. I'm sure it may have happened, but I don't think it was such a huge problem as they were trying to make out. I do think that if you cannot see the path at your feet, then you should at least have something on the horizon you can vaguely aim for. But easier said than done.
Well, I then had something, a note on path, which sprang from the fact that GURPS has a path book magic system.
Mm-hmm.
I have wanted for some time to write something about a magical school in which each person is having to make up their own path of magic, their own thing that they do magic about and with. But I think I may have made this a little too ambitious. And it may be, it's already out there. If I could just finish reading some of the books I've got in my in my to read pile.
So let us move on to Darkness.
Darkness is a pain in the ass for the GM. Who has the lantern? How far can it cast light? What happens if everything is plunged into darkness? It almost makes using VTT, a virtual tabletop, worthwhile. But I only say almost because it's going to be even more fuss learning how to use the blasted thing and to set it up. I generally pay attention to asking the question, who has the torch and where is it? But that's about as far as I can get.
Well, D&D fairly early brought on the continual light spell, and GURPS Dungeon Fantasy has something similar. And this is not super expensive to cast, and you can simply give everybody in the party an item, a medallion is traditional, which will emit light, but you can fold it shut if they actually need to be in the dark for some reason.
It's a dead giveaway and an announcement to the creepy crawlies that you're coming.
Well, yes, that's the thing.
I suspect there are some specialised magics in RuneQuest, I think, which allow people to have a light which only they can see, but I think it's reserved for the bad guys. I would say that a party enchantment that says you can see everybody else's light by everybody else's light source, but nobody can see by yours. Nobody outside the party can see what's going on. It probably exists somewhere. I can't be the most ingenious person in the world, can I?
I feel that there would be implications in terms of magic detection, but perhaps I'm wrong.
Good point.
And most of the party, most of the time I agree, a party can cope with whatever darkness there is, but all right, I played a lot of Harpoon in formative years, modern naval war game, and that has the consideration that you just raised, which is you have your lamp, and that will show you things within, say, 60 feet. Chances are that lamp can be detected from much further away than 60 feet. So, you might well want to not have the turning your cave exploration into a daylight endeavour, because you want potentially to sneak up on things, or at least not give them 20 minutes to lever up the big rock and set the ambush for you.
Run silent, run deep, walk into a wall.
The other thing that occurred to me was the darkness of interstellar space, because
vampires.
Well, yes. Well, not really. There is still light, but particularly the notion that the stars could have gone out literally years ago, and the light hasn't had time to get to you here. It's one that I find quite appealing when you have to go out on the hull to do some maintenance work in the middle of nowhere. Keep a good grip.
Okay. Mystery. What is a mystery?
I'm all about mysteries. I love investigative games, running them and playing them. I don't think it always has to be murder. I don't think it even necessarily has to be crime, but what one of the side notes I like putting in is here is this thing that is a bit weird, and perhaps in among other things, the PCs can gradually find out what's going on.
Yeah.
And maybe that will become very significant in the campaign. Maybe it will be relatively minor. In my World War II game, the interaction between magic and radioactivity.
Yeah.
Which nobody...
Was central.
It became central. Nobody had really expected it because nobody had tried putting both these things in the same place before. But because our party was magicians, the first time they went to the Rutherford Labs, they said, hang on, this is weird. and so on from there. But also...
Can I ask...
Is it these guys are doing that thing? Which, it may just be, well, they have their innate powers, TM, or it may be, well, they've made dark pacts, or it may be they've got these weird machines which we could steal and copy, or...
I have a personal question for you. In the Bayonne campaign, not to give any spoilers to anybody who hasn't played it yet, we recently had a first contact situation, and I figured out what was going on in the first set of questioning. And you told us afterwards that the other group who were going through it had taken several sessions to figure out what what seemed obvious to me.
I wouldn't say that they had got some idea of what was going on. They just didn't run away with their tails between their legs the way you lot did.
I think that was prudent.
It was certainly prudent. It was not very adventurous, but it was definitely prudent. I'm not going to argue with it.
Somebody else can go back and deal with that problem again. I know we annoyed one of the NPC specialists, but I think it was the all right. I have been rebuked. I'm not smart. I'm a chicken. Right. Fair enough.
But how do you feel about mystery?
I feel it's very hard to judge and very hard to do. What seems obvious to me has often been, how do you ever expect us to get that from my players? And one of the hardest things is not to assume knowledge that most people don't have.
I pick up a lot of little trivial bits of information, like Brunel inventing the Passover bar.
Yeah, quite. And I was one of the people who listened to the Doctor Who adventure with Diana Riggin and said, hang on, I'm perfectly certain that Jerusalem, that setting of Jerusalem, hadn't been written in the 1870s or whenever it was set. And I was right, too. But that I'm the sort of person who annoys people who write things about history.
I have a friend with whom I will not go to see a film set in the 1940s or earlier, because he will see a sign or something and say, that's Helvetica! I mean, he's right.
Yeah. Well, it's perfect. Yeah, but the matters of style often...
But the thing is, he knows it. He can't see it.
Well, yeah. There's a shot, I mentioned this before, I'm sure I've been boring about this before, in the Battle of Britain, which features a country cottage where one of the pilots has been living. And included in the shot is a door, which I know perfectly well had not been designed before about 1960, and it jarred really, really badly. But I think 99 people out of 100 would not see that. But for me, it was just a failure of the designer to be aware of what he was using.
Mm.
Anyway.
And you can't research everything, and the entire group of the audience will, between them, know about stuff that you've never heard of and do not have the scope to get right. So finding out what your players are into is obviously an advantage here. Speak to me of deceive.
That is very hard to do. There is a convention, and it's the only way I can think of us doing this. With Hobby, that the things that the GM tells you as GM are true, that he's reporting what your character's senses tell them, and he's only deliberately obfuscating things with the justification of failed sense rolls or something similar. But you are allowed to provide an NPC source of information which is either deliberately or unwittingly telling untruths, and you have to be very careful to make it clear to you. In fact, you have to do the funny voices to make it clear that the NPC is the person who's telling him that, and not and they may be overacting and gesturing and funny voices may be necessary. It's the only way to give people a consistent false source of information.
I can't remember the full phrase, but I know a GM in a campaign that had got into a lot of illusions and mind controls and things, having to say something along the lines of you've failed to recall noticing any change to the world, or worse to that effect, only even longer.
I think I could probably manage if I were planning it far enough in advance. to place somebody as trustworthy and as a person to be believed, and then betray that trust at a later date.
For me, as GM or as player, I would be happy with that as long as it felt plausible. You know, here is this person whom we actually got to know. They did have this more important thing to them than keeping trust with us. What was that more important thing? Can I understand how they might have found it more important? Yes, okay, that's fine. My players are a cynical lot, and they see through 150% of attempts to deceive them, which in itself is quite useful. So here is a perfectly genuine piece of information which I will tell them in an obviously dodgy way. And they will say, well, it can't possibly be that.
Again, this is the point at which you may want to yoink them back to the point. Sometimes you want them to chase the black sheep in the dark moon, which isn't actually there, and sometimes you don't. All right, overcome, shall we?
Deep in my heart, I do believe. I like the PCs to win as an overall thing, and not every time, not at every moment, but that's my overall goal in the campaign. The players like the PCs to win. Doesn't mean they need to get it all, but they will probably achieve what they came for. They will probably leave the world a better place.
I want to see them struggling.
Yes.
I want them to feel like they're struggling.
Yes, but at the same time, the just barely succeed is the thing I'm aiming for as an ideal outcome. I think one of the last remnants of the adversarial GMing style that I was talking about earlier is that it's very difficult to get players to accept that their PCs get captured. Killed in a fight, fair enough. But they will generally want to fight literally to the death if they possibly can, rather than submit to getting captured, even though in some genres that is a key move. You know, the villain knocks you out, he explains his plan, then he leaves you in a death trap. That's how you find out what the plan is.
It's not something they tell you in training, says 007, but...
And this is the thing. My answer to this is that I have to discuss it with the players. You know, if I just do it at them, then they will say force majeure. It feels like manipulation. It feels as if they didn't have a chance to fight their way out of it. Because they didn't. But...
I think the best result of that sort of action, throwing the stun gun, setting phases to stun and knocking everybody out, is to have almost everybody captured and leave somebody outside to do a daring rescue and generally screw things over from outside.
Yep, sounds good.
But that's ideal.
Renew.
I think the hardest thing to do sometimes, when you've been doing this as long as you and I have, is renewing your own enthusiasm, renewing your own capacity to remember why this was fun.
Well, it continues to be fun in the moment.
Yeah, but getting over the hump of starting a campaign and getting it established and pushing it towards where you think it should go, or even towards where the players should think it should go, can be hard. I find that I find that conventions help. Meeting new people, meeting people with whose enthusiasm hasn't been worn away. I think LARPs help because it's a whole body experience and gets you entirely involved in being somebody else for a short while. Something I've done, which I'm not sure I'm wise in doing, is sometimes renewing an old campaign and saying, that was fun once, let's see if I can do it again. Sometimes this works and sometimes it doesn't. And I think going on to a new thing, going on to a next thing, would be better for me psychically than going over things I have done in the past. On the other hand, the next generation sometimes works. when you go back to characters and locations and see how they've changed over time can be.
I think with a deliberate change is probably helpful in that regard. Yeah. I do sometimes worry that I'm basically doing the same old thing again and again as a GM. Some of that, of course, is because it works. I do try to reinvent things a bit with each new campaign. I don't know how successful that is, but I don't know.
Roger, what is the sign? And do you make it with your hands or your entire body?
No, you paint it in yellow, obviously.
Ew. Icky.
The thing that occurred to me here was getting lost in the woods, which is a traditional fantasy activity. But are these woods that other people travel through? And if so, there are probably paths and indeed signs, you know, little mouldering 3 miles.
Yeah, or perhaps it's a sign that somebody could read, but you can't. Maybe it's a thief's sign or a vagrant sign or something only the gnomes understand. Gnome sign.
The other thing that occurred to me, that there have been a lot of hidden prophecies, but I think the idea of a very public prophecy, everybody knows that there will be a chosen king and they will have these three signs and, oh crap, I've got two of them.
Yeah.
could be fun to play with.
That's Terry Pratchett, that is. Semiology. I would bring up semiology, except I'm not sure I really understand what it is. Except that signs need context, and meaning of signs change just as languages do.
Yeah, there have been various attempts to make universal systems of signage, and they are perfectly universal to other people who've grown up in the same cultural context as you. You can get bigger than a single language, but you cannot get universal to human, never mind multiple species. Destiny. Yeah.
Are you the destined one? Do you want to be the destined one? Are you destined for good or bad? I'm afraid you're destined to have a painful death. But until I can set up that particular painful death, you're not going to die at all. The old Gaius, you can only die half in and half out, standing on wood and standing on water.
You slip getting out of the bath?
Yeah, you slipped getting out of the coach, actually, I think. it's very difficult to do, and I wonder sometimes at people who choose destinies in character creation. It's a pain in the ass for the player to for the GM to set up. It's dead easy for the player, but if you've got a good destiny. But it is going to mean your end. Or you've got a bad destiny and it is going to mean your end. I can only see it making the player twitch. And I've never actually set up a campaign with a floating destiny. This is an idea that's only just occurred to me. A floating destiny where one person in the group is destined to do something. But nobody knows who it is, and it's going to emerge from the campaign. And I could see that being interesting. Make a note of it. I might use it later.
I'm very tempted by the real world option. After the great success has happened, you say, well, obviously this was destined. Look at these signs that we observed along the way and weren't able to recognise.
Yeah, that makes... That makes sort of sense, except it does require. Look, Churchill had a belief all through his life that he was destined to do something as spectacular as his ancestor did in the way of saving the nation, the first Duke of Marlborough did in the way of saving the nation. And he turned out to be right. But how many people out there are under such a conviction? And then they are going to go to their graves disappointed.
Well, quite. Particularly in role-playing, I'm not a great fan of destinies because I'd rather see what play provides. I don't love it in linear fiction, though. At least they you can make it work one way or the other. In role playing, in particular, it seems to force things too much for my taste. But not saying anybody else is. Can't do it better.
Okay, enter.
Sometimes you come to the orcs. Sometimes the orcs come to you. But somebody is going through an entrance, but what that entrance is going to be quite different depending on the situation. And this is what I was thinking of. Who built this entrance? Who uses it?
Yeah.
How often is it used? For what purpose? Are they, a selected set of people who could be told, press the third stone from the left to avoid the portcullis falling on you? Or is it open to passing salesmen?
Yeah, the point of entry to a secured building or a dungeon should always have a reason to be there, and should always have been, almost always have been constructed with the point of view of security. The dungeons are abandoned sometimes, and so are closed off buildings, and the creators may be decades or centuries past. The Lynns who go around exploring abandoned buildings probably know more about this than I do. But
but was it originally a fortress? Was it a tomb? Was it a storehouse? These decisions matter. That will affect the entrance especially, and the rest of the architecture behind it as well. So, unexpected.
What? Oh, no, put it there. Ah! That's how they should react to something unexpected. But I'm never certain when they're going to say, oh, yeah, Mike does this every time. When they're going to say, how the hell were we supposed to guess that? It's the old missing information thing. And I do get complaints occasionally that I've introduced something that nobody could have expected. And it's never the thing that I think it's going to be.
My feeling is that it's a mistake for me to try to be unexpected because it ends up feeling forced, but sometimes it happens and the players enjoy it. And I'm reminded of I think this was in Man to Man, the proto GURPS, that there is a limited scope for tricks in combat. If every fight could be won by kicking sand in somebody's face, barbarians would go around with bags of sand instead of axes.
Yeah. Well, a bag of sand and their axe, I think is the barbarian way.
So it's easy to overdo this. And those of you who waste time reading my blog will notice the thing I've been talking about with military fiction recently.
Yeah.
That it very often, because they want to emphasize this guy is the tactical genius, the hero, whatever, they will emphasize the terribly cunning trick that he comes up with, whereas the vast majority of battles are won not by coming up with a cunning trick, which often doesn't work, but by getting your blokes to keep fighting when the other side are giving up.
Yeah, most battles, I get the feeling, are won by chance and unreasonable determination, but some are occasionally won by the thing you prepared beforehand. And sometimes, as in the Battle of the Crater, sometimes the generals come along and take the trick away from the people that you carefully trained and give it to their favoured regiment instead. And it all goes to bugger.
And sometimes the players surprise the NPCs, as distinct from surprising me as the GM. And that's great fun.
Yes, but it does tend to lead to a quick and safe slaughter. I had them get the drop on a bunch of trolls last week, and the trolls, though big, strong, and nasty, didn't for some reason hear the bunch of idiots creeping up behind them. It was glorious for them, but not for me. Okay, ally.
The ally who goes along with the party is annoying, to a first approximation.
True.
If they're too competent, then they take over. If they're not competent enough, then it becomes an escort quest. We have to wrap this person in cotton wool while we do our thing.
That's not an outline. That's a package.
Yeah. What I think I've had most success with is the specialist, who is not a roughly tufty adventurer, but does, has a PhD in decoding ancient traps or something of that nature. So they have to be got to the ancient trap to disarm it.
Unlike a patron, I was going to contrast allies with patrons. He is pretty certain to be on the character's side. They may have limits about how far they will go to assist the character, but they start as being on the character's side. You can assume that an ally isn't a booby trap. I think that's only fair. They are the people who will do you favours, who will get you stuff, who will lend you their abilities to do whatever is needed.
And occasionally say, you ain't paying me enough for this, boss. And possibly a bit later, you can't pay me enough for this, boss.
Contacts are another, but contacts tend, unlike allies for some reason, tend to be a little bit shady. You absolutely know they're not going to get out of the office, but maybe they'll be able to get you the paperwork that you need and the equipment that you need.
Yeah, because I find the escort side of things annoying, I do like the ally who is sitting in a sort of inchoate probability smear and can be spat out by the machinery of the universe where they're actually needed because, I just happen to be doing stuff here.
Now that is stretching things a little bit. But I think that should be a special enhancement. In GURPS.
When it's always convenient for them, not when it's convenient for the players.
All right. Well, that's going to be inconvenient for everybody.
Recently,
previously in the city of Glamour, I turn to the players and I say, tell the person who wasn't here last week what you did last week. Yeah. The roundup of the recent events is a feature of the start of my games in an ongoing campaign, and the moral question here is when I interrupt when they are remembering it wrong, do I just let it go and see what develops, or do I say, actually, no, you didn't do that. And actually, the senator didn't say that. And actually, but sometimes, purely out of mischief, and because I can see how they can manage to get it so wrong, I'll let it ride. It's a moral judgment, one which I frequently fail.
There was a actual play group called The Stars Are Right, who, as far as I can tell, they never actually explained how this happened, but I think what they did was, at the end of each session, they would pick a player to record the recap, and that would then be played back at the beginning of the next session. I have never got that organised.
I'm normally knackered enough at the end of a session that I do not...
Oh, it was always one of the players doing this.
Well, yeah, frequently players are full of energy and full of bubble and pleased with themselves, and I'm just knackered at the end of a session. I think, right, let's wrap it up there. Let me turn off the recording. Oh, now what?
Oh, I didn't turn off the recorder until everybody's signed off. What I thought about this was more in terms of recent publications. I don't do a lot of buying new RPGs. I'm interested, but mostly I'm fairly happy with the stuff I have and the incremental improvements it gets, rather than a huge let's do everything new at once.
I was tempted by the new edition of 13th Age, but only because I admire the system, the setting so much, not the system, which is D20 based, and I have a limited toleration. But I have plenty of settings where I bought the book for the setting and despair at the game, and so I really didn't need any more.
And if like us, you download the occasional bundles of holding because we're because as we've said occasionally, we do get freebies and in return for occasionally promoting them. But you have an awful lot of stuff that you are frankly never going to run. That's certainly true of me.
Yeah. But it's there for inspiration and for gutting and reanimating in an undead form when you need it.
Though I do think that there is this basic problem with commercial RPG publishing, because the best games, not rule sets but actual campaigns played, are the ones that are largely put together by the people involved.
Hmm.
If they are good at doing it, which obviously not all groups are. And those people, you don't need to sell anything other than the rules.
Yeah.
And the more you lock stuff down in order to have more things to sell, more character abilities, a more specific game world with more specific places in it, more adventures, more campaigns, the less you appeal to the people who are actually going to do those great games. It makes more people able to roleplay, but it doesn't make them really great roleplayers. If they're enjoying it, that's great. That's fine. But
I wonder how much of TSR's of Wizards of the Coast, Hasbro's business, is generated by new enthusiasts. Because what they're going for at the moment does not appear to me to be selling to ongoing hobbyists.
Hmm. I don't know people who enthuse about that stuff anymore. They may well be out there, but I don't cross... Well, clearly they are, because Hasbro's still in business, but I don't seem to cross paths with them.
Okay. Roger, reveal.
Surprises, good. Surprises that the players think are unfair, bad.
Mm.
There's one... this is going to be a spoiler for the campaign Horror on the Orient Express, so if you haven't played that and you think you might, skip forward a few minutes. There is a moment in that campaign, towards the end, in which it is revealed that the entire endeavour that the player characters have been doing all this time was essentially on behalf of the bad guys. It was all a trick, and now they have to go and try to fix it.
Yeah.
And the problem with that for me is if it were... If it were just that we genuinely believed this and, oh dear, we've been betrayed, fair enough. But the problem in something like this is you've got this great big adventure boxed set, and near the beginning of it, somebody says, please do this thing for me. And if you say no, you don't get to use the great big adventure boxed set. This is a meta-level concern. The players have to think, yes, we have to do this, no matter how suspicious we might be, because it is clearly the path to the adventure. And to say to that, ha ha, you were wrong, is saying, well, you shouldn't have been playing this adventure, you idiots. It just rubs me wrong.
It is using a meta concern, a meta argument to get people involved in things, and I think we've already said that that's not a good way to go. There is another Cthuloid adventure, I won't mention the name, I know of, in which it's revealed at the end that not only is everything they have done pointless, but they're going to have to do another hideous thing if they're going to prevent something even worse. And I felt that that was... Taking irony and bashing the head and bashing it over the heads of the players. I don't see any way that would be fun. But other people may have more masochistic tendencies than I do.
Well, I think in general I enjoy Call of Cthulhu more than you, but that doesn't sound particularly fun for me either. Challenge.
All right, this is obscure. I went and saw the Fantastic Four movie. It's like the Superman movie I enjoyed. Not as much as I did the Superman movie, but it's still a good Fantastic Four movie, which is astounding. And it has been said, I'm not sure quite how truly, that the Fantastic Four were inspired by DC's comic Challengers of the Unknown. And the Fantastic Four are the challengers with superpowers. A team of ex-war buddies who did heroic things by going to the weird places where no one had gone before. And it struck me, first of all, that the end of the Second World War is a unique time for creating that sort of team. I don't quite believe... I mean, yeah, there have been wars since. I suppose you could believe, but the end of a good war and people who want to keep on doing heroic things is a good combination for creating legends.
See previous comments on Thor Heyerdahl.
Yeah.
But also a thing that became very obvious when I did some research a few years back for an article on safecracking. The golden years of safe-blowing are always just after a major war, when there are lots of young men with explosive skills and boredom.
Yeah. And therefore, our challenge of challenges is what I came up with. I wasn't concerned with any... I can see making a 1950s campaign where people who have been buddies in the war are going and doing strange things. I would make it on the edge of the fantastic and the weird, perhaps even more than the challengers went for. Perhaps somewhere in the middle between the challengers and the Fantastic Four. I can think that could be fun. And I think Britain in the 1950s could also be a good place to encounter the weird and encounter things that have to be faced down. But
you'll have to excuse me as someone who wasn't there, but when I have seen depictions of it, whether contemporaneous or otherwise, it has always seemed a bit, okay, well, we did that, and now everything's a bit rubbish.
Yeah, everything was a bit rubbish, but we did our best, and I don't see any reason why there could not be things going on in the background of our suffering in the 1950s that could make for an interesting campaign, but that's a long-term thing. What do you think when you think of challenge?
I confess I think of challenge ratings and balanced encounters, and I regard this as basically a pointless lie. Some things are too easy to be a fair fight. That doesn't mean you should never meet them. Some things are too hard to be a fair fight. That doesn't mean you should never meet them either. This is not a war game.
True.
You have other solutions, like going away, or social skills, downright bribery. That all of this to me is much more interesting than I will line up my people and you will line up your people. We will bash each other until somebody isn't moving anymore. I do think there's a strong strand in folk heroes of being the guy with the inferior forces who wins the day by being clever.
Yeah,
and again, you don't get that in a balanced encounter, even if it actually is balanced.
I have a very unclear idea of how to create something that's a challenge but won't kill them. It's something that I've never been entirely sure of. And I've seen giants who should have taken a good long fight to defeat, knocked down by one's slingshot to the brain, which is, you know, traditional. But this is not what I was planning on.
Especially true in my experience in if you're doing trying to do D&D type things in GURPS, because D&D is basically attritional. Bash you lose some hit points. You bash me, you lose some hit points. The numbers on how often I successfully bash you, how many hit points you lose, how many points you had to start with, will stack up to see who's going to win that fight, with obviously some room for probability. But in GURPS, generally, I will bash you and you defend, you will bash me and I defend, until one of us lands a blow. And very often that first blow will determine the winner of the fight. Which is more realistic, but not very Dungeons and Dragonsy.
No, true. RuneQuest is, which is where the giant was, has hit locations and... The range of you can keep on fighting with some wounds, but there are also a range of things that are going to take you out straight away or render you helpless and liable to surrender.
Yeah.
Which is more realistic, but also equally difficult to plan for. Nemesis.
And I have sometimes tried setting up a campaign where the nemesis was known at least by me in advance, but I think the gradual realization that someone is the power behind all these things is much more interesting than if they introduce themselves in episode one, not thinking of any Flash Gordon in particular.
I think Nemesis has a sense of divine justice, and it was one of the...
Yes, true. It tends to be abused to mean the big boss at the end of the campaign, but I agree.
Yeah. It was a nickname of Jane Marple in her last appearance. Nemesis is the inescapable agent of someone's downfall, a long-standing rival, an arch-enemy.
It's what comes after hubris.
Yeah, the goddess who personified... Yeah, the goddess who personified the divine vengeance that comes after hubris, which the gods are unaccountably sensitive about.
Well, obviously, it's the path to godhood.
Oh, right. So, if you're sufficiently proud, you're going to be a god sometime, and the gods want to cut that off knees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could do worse. Tactics.
Well, tactical war games are where the hobby sprang from, and there's a lot of fun to be had, but it can be also bore some players silly. The systems that we like, systems like RuneQuest and GURPS, do tactical very well. They make maximum allowance for the sudden surprise, cunning move, the thing that occurs to the player at the moment and in the situation where they are. But if you're going to feed them nothing but that, they're going to get bored and want to do other stuff.
The exceptional thing has to be exceptional.
Yeah. And some people don't want to do tactics, no tactics more complicated than do I dodge or do I parry this time? Is enough for some people.
Yeah,
something like GURPS tactical shooting, or the martial arts books. They tend to be more interesting to particular specialized players, and if I get somebody who's interested in that sort of thing, I'm going to let them do that sort of thing and do that sort of particular thing and hope that they're getting it right, because I don't want to have to learn those systems, honestly.
One thing I particularly like about tactical shooting is that it's essentially saying, if you want to be a very, very specialised shooter who has all this special extra gear that takes time to use but can set up some really amazing shots, you can. But somebody else in the party doesn't have to do that. They can do something else.
Yeah.
They can run and gun, or they can be your medics or your techies or whatever else. You don't have to have... It isn't one of the... Martial arts for 3rd edition GURPS, in my experience, was a bit of a step change. Any character who had been built with the martial arts rules could beat up in a fight any character who hadn't been. Unless there was a massive power disparity. And I'm glad to... So basically, at that point, if you used martial arts in your game, everybody had to use it. And I'm glad to say that tactical shooting doesn't do that for me.
Hmm.
So I much prefer the... It's not even modular per campaign. It's saying, okay, your character is the godlike sniper. He can use these rules. Nobody else has to. I have a character who really ought to be using these rules, and I shall have to have a look at them. It's a separate concern.
I'm not sure. There are probably games which we're not playing, which make the tactical situation more interesting than and more acceptable to players. But I think that some players, I know I have some, just don't want to get involved in the precise simulation of who hits who and how hard.
Yeah, and there are definitely games which make this extremely fuzzy. Anything that uses range bands tends to go a bit in that direction. And sometimes it really doesn't matter. I am quite happy to play a tactical war game, but I will want to play an actual tactical war game. I don't want to do that in my role-playing.
Yeah.
I recommend War of the Nine Realms. Buy it. It's a great game. I get paid to demonstrate it, but I'm not being paid right now.
Okay, but that's enough about tactics. Suspense. What is it?
You know something is going to leap out at you. Something is going to happen. But you don't know just what, and you don't know just when.
Yeah.
This is tricky. I like fake scares. What a film critic might call the spring-loaded cat. You open the cupboard and there's this meow and the thing leaps out at you. And at least it wasn't the monster. That can work well in a game as well. Trickier to do but, the interpersonal. I'm thinking of the film Rope, for example, where there is suspense in the sense of clearly one of these criminals is going to break down, but when are they going to do it and how is it going to come out? And that I think is much harder to do in a game.
That's the suspense in Columbo as well. They're going to be found out, but how? I think the team structure of most RPGs works against the delay in revelation, and you have to work hard to frighten everybody at the table, and get everybody. Perhaps the one-on-one format would work best. In fact, from what little we did at one time, I would say that the one-on-one works best when your character is on their own and trying to figure out what is going on and believes that there is extreme danger out there, which with the Cthuloid adventure that we ran, there is, definitely.
Just recently I was thinking about The Shadow of Rinsmouth, and if you had a party doing that, you would not get the same progression of fear and panic, because you know, here is one guy on his own. Anything he is not personally looking at could be moving around and out to get him. If you have two of you, you can go back to back. You can sleep in shifts. You can share a quick joke to break the tension. One person on their own can't do that. And games, by their nature, tend to be not one person on their own.
Hmm. Except when it's deliberately done, and that is very much a minority taste.
My experience of it was much harder work for me as a player. This is not a bad thing, but it did need to be much more on while we were doing it. How would you say that was as a GM?
It was certainly intense, and I was feeling my way around an unfamiliar system. But I did like the opportunity I had to say, here's what you see, here's what's happening to you. And the focus of feeding the storyline to just one player was very satisfying.
Hmm. Connect.
This makes me think of cork boards and bits of string across them, working out the relationships amongst a set of clues. That I have seen a photograph of the cork board after a whole day session of the Dracula dossier, and it was an impressive sight. I don't know if and it made it look as though it was worthwhile to get all those players into one place and thinking about the problem at the same time. I don't think it's something you can do most of the time, but maybe if you could build up the things that have happened in the game enough and get them thinking.
Surely there's a website that gives you a shared conspiracy board. Premium users get three different widths of red string.
Oi. Yeah, all right. Cool. That's the only thing that Connect made me think of.
I was also thinking of the conspiracy map and thinking, if possible, let the players build it and listen carefully to try to make as much of that true as possible.
Yeah, and if you're going to... Yeah, I think if it's possible, but I don't know. Maybe I like it when they say, aha, that must mean, and they get it right. Mm. Yeah.
And I think, to be fair, that's what something like Brindlewood Bay is trying to do. In its there is no official right answer, it's saying when the players have that moment of, aha, that must mean, they're right.
Yeah.
That, yeah.
Experience.
Well, the first thing I think of is experience points. We've talked before about the whole treadmill of improvement and so on. But it occurs to me that the experience, the memory of a campaign is basically what's left after it's happened.
Yeah.
Unless you're recording it and whatever, but broadly. Should we optimise for that? How should we optimise for that?
By recording. The players' memories will not be the GM's memories. And the players' memories will differ. But the stories we tell afterwards are indeed the best final product we have. Experience... I've seen campaigns that don't have it at all. Pardon me.
Classic Traveller barely had it.
I've seen campaigns which don't have it very much. I've seen things like Fate, which I think Fate is saying that change is a good enough substitute for experience. But I'm not sure that's true either.
Well, some of this was the early D&D idea of you start off with a basic character who grows into a hero. And modern games, particularly since the campaigns don't last as long, are quite happy to say, well, you're going to start off as a big damn hero.
Yeah.
Doc Savage does not get skill boosts.
Pathfinder starts with you're a lowly worm, and then you may start out as somebody with the potential to become a hero eventually. But, I'm not sure about this. I found the change structure in Fate to be particularly unnecessarily complicated and downright peculiar. And I, on the other hand, I can see a case for saying you gain a level when it feels right for you to gain a level and not to be counting all those pesky experience points and requiring the GM to think... are 15 kobolds worth as much as 20 halflings? Who can tell?
Yeah, there are some campaigns that definitely have enough structure that you can say, right, this is the end of a chapter, this is the end of one of the books of the trilogy, that kind of thing. Not always, but there are some that do.
Yeah, it does require a degree of foreshadowing and planning, which I think may be...
And finally, reward.
Let's say that there are rewards that the players might reasonably expect and might want. I think the trick is to make the reward feel real and make it something that doesn't kill the campaign, if you want the campaign to go on. If you don't want the campaign to end, then heck, give them the hand of the princess and half the kingdom. But if becoming rich and well established is something that's going to stop the character ever going out again and ever doing anything adventurous ever again, then you should think about it very carefully. In fact, you probably ought to say to the players before you issue the rewards, do you want this game to continue sometime or what?
I think that ties back to what we were just saying about party games versus one-on-one, because for a single character, it's fine to say, you know, you're ne'er-do-well trudging from dungeon to dungeon. Now in the next book, you have to navigate court politics.
Ooh, that's a thing.
But for a party, you have to have them all doing that, or it doesn't really work.
Yeah. I don't know. Some people might decide their character's going to drop out, and they'll come up with another low-life character.
Well, that would be another approach, I think, to say, okay, I want to keep running the dungeon-bashing campaign, as it might be, or the investigative, you are low-level cops campaign, but... If you want to retire a character and say, right, you are now well respected in the city, and maybe you might be a future patron NPC, then you can bring in a new character.
Yeah. The thought flashed across my mind while we were discussing this about wondering whether Robin Laws has ever thought of doing a one-on-one dungeon crawling campaign. I don't think so, because only a person who goes down a dungeon on their own is probably insane. To start with, but it's just an idle curiosity whether there is something for the solo adventurer, maybe for the adventurous thief or the adventurous assassin.
Well, do bear in mind they wouldn't necessarily have to go down the dungeon on their own if they had a small mob of henchmen to do the keeping a lookout and carrying stuff and so on.
Yeah,
but they still have to do the important stuff like the spotting the traps.
And killing the henchmen when they need an extra boost. That is a Munchkin reference, by the way.
Hey.
Are we done? I think we got.
I
to
think
the end.
So. Yeah, for another year.
All right. I think that's enough for a month. I think it feels like enough for a month and a half, having come to the end. So let us wrap it up and roll it out and see what the world whether the world runs it up the flagpole and salutes it. And if you have your own contributions to the gathered wisdom, which we have displayed so nobly before you, you can tell us about it by contacting us at...
I'll leave a message on the website or email podcast@tekeli.ly.
And we will be back with something more focused next month.